Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are always in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This is Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and moderator of today's program. It is now my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Leon Panetta, Director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Leon Panetta is a native son of California who has often been called to national service. From an Italian immigrant family that settled in Monterey, he attended Santa Clara University and then Santa Clara University Law School. He served from 1964 to 1966 as an Army intelligence officer. After practicing law for 5 years, he embarked on his public service career, serving as an assistant to New York Mayor John Lindsay and California Senator Thomas Kuchel, and as director of the U.S. Office of Civil Rights. Mr. Panetta was first elected to Congress from the Monterey Peninsula in 1977, serving until 1993 and becoming chair of the House Budget Committee. After serving as director of the Office of Management and Budget, from 1994 until 1997, he was White House Chief of Staff, serving President Clinton. Mr. Panetta returned home to found the Panetta Institute, based at Cal State Monterey Bay, where with his wife Sylvia, he worked for a decade to nurture values of public service and leadership in young people through courses, through public service projects, through mentorship, and many other methods. His wife Sylvia Panetta carries on that work today. Mr. Panetta served as a member of the Iraq Study Group appointed in 2006, and in February of this year was appointed director of the CIA. Many observers believe that rebuilding and refocusing this important U.S. government agency will demand all of the considerable skill that Mr. Panetta brings to the job. Throughout his long career, Mr. Panetta has come to be known as a straight shooter, a person not only with a strong grasp of public policy and the ability to lead on important issues, but with a strong sense of ethics, good judgment, and honesty. He is one of those rare people in public service who finds common ground between those who disagree and so brings us together so we can focus on solving the problems that confront us. We are fortunate to have had the privilege of welcoming Mr. Panetta several times to the club's podium, including as a keynote speaker at our centennial conference 6 years ago. We always appreciate your insights and are delighted to welcome you back today to hear about your work at the CIA. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Leon Panetta.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to have the opportunity to speak to the Commonwealth Club again. And I want to thank Gloria for inviting me, and especially want to thank her for her continuing great leadership of this great organization. I'm always honored to have the opportunity to be here. First of all, as you know, because I'm a Californian, and I was born and raised in California, in Monterey, I had the honor of as Gloria pointed out, of representing the Central Coast in the Congress for 16 years, and then had the opportunity to, after serving as Chief of Staff to the President, to return to our home and establish the Panetta Institute, which Sylvia continues to run in at the campus there at CSU Monterey Bay. And our home is and will forever be in Carmel Valley. So I thank you for giving me a chance to get the hell out of Washington and come home. Secondly, I'm always honored because of this forum. The Commonwealth Club, I believe, really does provide one of the great public forums in the country. You have hosted some of the great leaders in our nation's history. You have conducted forums that I think carry on a very important tradition. It's the kind of public dialogue that I think was envisioned by our forefathers that allows people to present different views and allows people to listen to those views and form their own judgments on the issues. I can't tell you how important it is to continue those kinds of forums in these times of partisanship and political conflict. We need to be able to dialogue with one another about our thoughts on the toughest issues that face this country. I've had the honor, as Gloria pointed out, to speak at the Commonwealth Club's 100th anniversary. And I'm honored, again, as I said, that you've asked me to participate and have this opportunity again. Now, I've learned a long time ago not to guess where life will lead you. My career, as Gloria has pointed out, has spanned over 40 years. But I'm fairly certain that none of us would have predicted in 2003 that I would be here one day as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. But when the president asks you to serve, you answer that call. And the chance to lead the CIA, a critical organization in these times, critical times, was an offer that, after 40 years of public service, gave me yet another challenging opportunity to serve this nation. Without question, this is the most challenging job I've had in Washington. But at the same time, it's also one of the most rewarding. Because of our mission, because of the people who work in this agency, but most of all, because of the duty we have to try to keep this nation safe. The United States, in the 21st century, in the year 2009, truly is at a major crossroads in its management of the economy, in energy, in health care, in deficits, the way we handle our budget, in immigration, in climate change, in terrorism, in nuclear proliferation, and in our relationship with the rest of a very changing and global world. We are fighting an enemy that is still determined to strike us overseas and strike us here at home. The recent arrest of an Al-Qaeda operative in this country, something we haven't seen since the year 2007, only confirms that Al-Qaeda continues to plan attacks on our homeland. Leading an agency that is on the front lines of the defense of our country, particularly in the battle with Al-Qaeda and its violent allies, is an important and very awesome responsibility. And particularly awesome for me, because it oftentimes involves decisions that involve life and death. In 8 months as director, I certainly have learned a great deal. I've learned a lot about the substance of our challenges, the men and women, the CIA, the agency's unique capabilities, and how all of this relates to protecting our national security and our freedoms. There is oftentimes a debate about the role of an intelligence agency in our democracy. The fact is that an intelligence agency is critical to the survival of our democracy. Our forefathers blessed this nation with a constitution and a Bill of Rights that expresses our fundamental beliefs, our fundamental freedoms and values. The leaders of America have a duty to protect the nation and strengthen and preserve those ideals. A strong defense and an enlightened diplomacy are essential to fulfilling that duty. And none of that is possible. None of that is possible without credible and accurate intelligence. No president can make important decisions regarding our national security without knowing what our enemies are thinking, what they're planning, and what they're doing. Our job is to give the president that knowledge so that he can make the right decisions. And that is what the president asked of me when he offered me this job, and that's what I pledged to him. I believe that when the CIA does its duty and does it well, not only do we protect the American people, not only do we provide the important information that has to be provided to our president and our leaders, but hopefully, if we do our job, we can move beyond the divisive political charges and countercharges of the past. We can, as a nation, learn the lessons of the past without getting trapped by the past. Trust is essential in our democracy. Trust is essential between the people and their government. Trust is essential between Republicans and Democrats. And trust is essential to our intelligence effort. My goal in this job is to restore that trust. Neville Chamberlain, after he resigned in 1940 as Prime Minister of Great Britain, found that there was a tremendous amount of political pressure to delve deeply into the actions that he took at Munich to forestall military conflict with Germany. Winston Churchill was being pressured to conduct that investigation, and he knew the toll that it would take, and he knew that it would not be particularly wise at a time of war. He said something that I've used often to express the importance of focusing on the future. And I quote, "If we open a quarrel between the past and the present, we shall find that we have lost the future," unquote. Nowhere is that more true than in intelligence. The CIA's full attention must be on the challenges we confront today and those over the horizon. That's what I want to talk to you about this afternoon, the work of the CIA now and in the future. First, what should you expect of an intelligence agency in a democracy? And second, what is the CIA doing in order to meet those expectations? All intelligence consumers, policymakers I talked about, military commanders, need timely, objective, independent, and accurate intelligence. They must know and understand the world as it is if they are to make sound decisions in the hopes of changing it for the better. Providing that knowledge, that understanding, is CIA's fundamental responsibility. My job is not to tell the president what he wants to hear. My job is to tell him the truth, whether he likes it or not. That is what our nation's leaders and the American people should expect Central Intelligence Service to do. You should expect us to conduct operations and help protect American lives here and overseas, and to do so in keeping with our laws. We should not have to choose between our safety and our values. That must be the fundamental rule as to how you achieve national security in a free society. You should expect us at the CIA to live by that rule. You should expect us to support our men and women in uniform, deploying to the field alongside the military, as we do, so that our war fighters have the information they need in order to prevail. You should expect us not only to know today's threats, but identify emerging dangers and opportunities. It is the duty of the CIA, perhaps more than any other agency, to minimize the risk of surprise. Ultimately, the CIA will be judged, and our value to the United States will be measured by our success in delivering on the expectations I just outlined. We strive to meet those expectations by bringing powerful and unique capabilities to our defense. We deploy case officers throughout the world to find secrets that the United States can get no other way. We build and deploy technical tools that provide clandestine access to essential information. We provide independent, all-source analysis of a full range of national security issues, both tactical and strategic. All of the intelligence we gather by human intelligence, by technical intelligence, means very little if we don't combine it with the analysis of what that information means. And we conduct covert action at the direction of the president. Here, our mission moves beyond just acquiring information to taking action. And we do it in a way that represents the kind of covert action that every president has used since Harry Truman. These core tasks, each of them central to the CIA's mission since its founding, are performed by our clandestine service officers, by our analysts, by our scientists, by our technicians, and they're enabled by an infrastructure and a professional support staff that is without comparison in the intelligence community. Nearly half of the officers at the CIA are in what we call the Directorate of Support, that part of the agencies that builds the facilities out of scratch in the Afghan mountains, that keeps our computers secure and our people safe and healthy. It's quite an operation. My responsibility as director is to ensure that the agency's talented people and robust capabilities are responding to the needs, the intelligence needs of the nation, and that we are responding with honesty and with integrity and with accuracy. My goal is to bring the CIA, in a word, into the 21st century with a workforce that reflects the nation we serve and the world we live in. Let me tell you about what we're doing in some of the high priority areas. There are four areas I want to discuss: counterterrorism, counterproliferation, cybersecurity, and the global arena in terms of our target responsibilities. On counterterrorism, this is the priority role that we are involved with. The president has made very clear that job one is to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda and their extremist allies. Working closely with our allies throughout the world, the United States has made, I believe, significant progress against this very dangerous enemy. In the tribal areas of Pakistan, Al-Qaeda's senior leaders are under tremendous pressure. Top-ranking terrorists, rank-and-file militants, have been taken off the battlefield in rapid succession. The aggressive campaign that began last year, we believe, is disrupting Al-Qaeda's operations and their training, making it more difficult for these groups to raise the money, to plot attacks, and to plan for the future. The combination of these operations, plus now the boots on the ground, the fact that the Pakistani military, is moving into the Fatah, the tribal areas where these terrorists and where Al-Qaeda are located, provides a very important 1-2 punch that is critical to disrupting Al-Qaeda's ability to conduct effective operations. As successful as our efforts have been in the Afghan-Pakistan border, the CIA cannot be satisfied. It is not enough simply to disrupt the danger emanating from the tribal areas today. We have got to anticipate that Al-Qaeda, their next move will be to find other safe havens. And our challenge is to block its flight to those safe havens. The agency has sharpened its focus on places where Al-Qaeda will run to regroup, and they usually move to failed states. We are looking at Somalia, at Yemen, North Africa, areas in Southeast Asia. We have to be ready if the enemy shifts major resources to these areas and to these safe havens. This is not about simply monitoring the process. This is about interdicting it and blocking their ability to find other areas that they can operate from. As I said, the agency's job is not only about the present. It has to be about the future. Unless we stay one step ahead, we are not fully accomplishing our mission. We take the same approach to our work in Iraq and Afghanistan. CIA officers have been fighting Al-Qaeda and its allies in Afghanistan since September of 2001. Today, we are expanding operations in the field and adding staff at headquarters. More officers from every part of the agency are now being deployed to that country. The mission, as laid out by the President, is to help stabilize Afghanistan so that it never becomes a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. No matter how U.S. policy there evolves, the CIA will be very close to the center of that effort. And the reason is clear. You can't make good policy unless you understand the people, the situation on the ground, the tribes, the districts, the history, the culture, the politics of this tortured nation. And that's largely the job of the CIA. In Iraq, too, our officers are making a difference during this critical transition period. CIA is now planning for a post-war footprint in that country. We will have to do our job under vastly different circumstances than in the past 6 years. As the military draws down, there will be no corresponding drawdown in the demand for intelligence. Policymakers will continue to rely on the CIA to collect information, to assess and understand the remaining threats to Iraq's long-term peace and stability. General Odierno, Prime Minister Maliki, the leadership there has said, we need to have this intelligence more now than ever as our military draws down. The second area I wanted to talk about is counterproliferation. Helping to stop the deadly spread of weapons is another top priority for the CIA. The demand for intelligence is very high as policymakers and diplomats grapple with how we respond to the nuclear programs, particularly in Iran and North Korea. Some excellent intelligence work made possible the president's public disclosure last month that Iran was building an undeclared uranium enrichment plant. This is the kind of intelligence success that usually is never heard about. But in this instance, it established the fact that we had gathered the intelligence on this facility over a period of time, working with our allies, working with our foreign partners. We knew what Iran was up to. We presented that case to our policymakers. They asked that we prepare a briefing on this to be ready in the event that this issue would be disclosed. And when it appeared that it would be disclosed, we sent our briefers to the IAEA in Vienna to make the case for why this was a hidden facility. In North Korea, we provided full support to policymakers both before and after North Korea's nuclear and missile tests. But we have to do even better. We're working to gain greater insight into the leaders of these countries, the decision-making process that's involved, particularly when it comes to the issues I just discussed. When the stability of entire regions is at stake, no effort is too great. We have got to know both the capabilities and the intentions of all states that either have or aspire to weapons of mass destruction. Let me mention a third area that's becoming of increasing concern, which is the area of cybersecurity. The agency is working with partners throughout government to understand the threat from hackers, from foreign intelligence services, and from other adversaries that are trying to penetrate or disrupt vital computer systems. In my mind, the next Pearl Harbor could very well come from a cyber attack on our power grid, our financial centers, or our transportation systems. Cyber attacks are increasing in number and sophistication. Our operators and analysts are focused on trying to figure out who is targeting the United States in cyberspace. What systems do they want to infiltrate? What capabilities are they using to get at us? With that knowledge and understanding, our government can develop defenses and we can work to neutralize the threat. The last area I wanted to mention is that regarding global coverage in today's world. Counterterrorism, support to the military in the war zones, counterproliferation, cybersecurity are obviously high-profile, high-priority missions. But they only represent part of our responsibility. The agency must also provide global coverage. It must know the whole world. For example, we have to stay on top of developments in countries like China, Russia, India, Brazil, Mexico, Venezuela, Cuba, and nations from the Horn of Africa to Southeast Asia, from Latin America to Eastern Europe, from the Middle East to the Balkans. We've got to be prepared to handle simmering hotspots that suddenly boil over very quickly and can overwhelm policymakers. The conflict in Georgia in August of 2008 represents one of those examples. The coup in Honduras earlier this year represents another example of that kind of sudden conflict that can face us. At the same time, we've got to inform policymakers about potential crises down the road, problems that could result from demographics, from natural resource trends. Let me give you some examples. Consider the fact that one out of every three people in the developing world lives in a slum and is living in terrible poverty. The number of people living in those conditions is expected to grow by 50% to 1.5 billion in the next 15 years. So many more people with few educational or economic opportunities could worsen ethnic or religious tensions and increase social unrest. Another example, the number of people suffering from chronic hunger has risen to more than 1 billion, a 25% increase since the year 2000. This vulnerable group bears the brunt of rising food prices, as we saw last year. The jump in prices led to calls for more humanitarian aid, as well as protests and violence in a number of countries. Another area, climate change. Helping policymakers understand the national security implications of global warming is also a part of the CIA's global mission. We recently opened a center dedicated to this issue. Its charter is not the science of climate change, but the national security impact of things like rising sea levels, population shifts, and increasing competition for natural resources. The center will provide support to policymakers as they negotiate, implement, and verify international agreements. And it will reach out to the academic world and to think tanks that are studying climate change. The objective is obvious. It's better knowledge and insight on a topic that is very worthy of our attention. The whole purpose here is to make sure we are not surprised. It's the CIA's charge to help policymakers foresee and understand and meet all of these challenges. Our focus on urgent threats and on these hard targets cannot leave us vulnerable to surprise anywhere in the world. After 8 years of intense focus on counterterrorism and support for the military, we have to be careful that we are not so focused on the obvious threats that we become vulnerable to the ones that are not so obvious. To confront this challenge, the CIA will do everything possible to ensure that we are a truly global service. We've got to develop stronger capacity to cover emerging regional powers. We've got to build deeper analytic bench strength in order to give the president advanced knowledges on these crises. And we've got to do more to collect and analyze information that is hidden from plain sight. And none of this is easy, and none of this is cheap. Given the current state of the federal budget, something that I'm very familiar with, as former chairman of the House Budget Committee and as director of the Office of Management and Budget, the CIA will have to find ways to accomplish its goals without some kind of big new infusion of funds. The agency must become more efficient in the way we operate. One of my goals is, frankly, to reduce our dependence on contractors by a total of 20%. This year alone, by doing that, we can produce savings of up to $100 million. With the help of the senior leadership of the agency, I've taken a comprehensive look at where are we today and where do we have to be in 5 years from now. As I said earlier, the goal is always to be one step ahead, identifying tomorrow's challenges and aligning resources to meet them. We intend to be clear about our needs in defending the country. But I also will insist that when the agency goes to the administration and the Congress for resources, that we can justify those requests with candor and with credibility. Much has been said and written in recent months about the agency's relationship with Capitol Hill. Let me give you my perspective. I cannot do this job without the support and partnership of the Congress. At a time of partisanship and distrust, more so than I've ever seen in the 40 years that I've been in Washington, every issue becomes part of a soundbite war. My goal must be to try to restore trust between the CIA and the Congress, both parties in the Congress. Having served in the Congress for 16 years, having worked with the Congress in a number of other capacities, I know the value of a solid relationship with the oversight committees. If the CIA is to have the resources and authorities it needs to accomplish its mission, Lawmakers must understand what we do and have confidence in how we do it. At the best, oversight improves the agency, making it stronger and making it more effective. That's why I've spent a great deal of time and energy reaching out to the Congress and to many of my former colleagues. I need both parties, Democrats and Republicans, to support our mission. I cannot do this job alone. I need the support and trust of the Congress to establish the kind of partnership that they have to assume in protecting the national security. And finally, let me talk a little bit about the people at CIA. More than any of our strategic plans and initiatives, the single greatest influence on our agency's future will be the people who devote themselves to our mission. My job is to ensure that they have the skills, the tools, and the training they need to get this job done. Let me mention two areas of special emphasis. First, language training. As someone who represented an area that had the Defense Language Institute and the Monterey Institute of Languages, these are schools that provide important language training. And as a boy, during the time I was in Congress, I always felt that one of the things that, frankly, this country has not emphasized is language training. At the CIA, we have to have good language training for members of the CIA. I've announced a new program to increase language training, particularly for analysts and for collectors of intelligence. I grew up speaking Italian, and I know for all of you who speak a foreign language, you will agree that it deepens your understanding of other countries and other cultures, of their history and their worldviews. It's a deep level of understanding that is crucial to gathering and assessing intelligence. Within 5 years, my goal is to double the number of collectors and analysts who are proficient in a foreign language. Mission-critical languages, such as Chinese, Arabic, Urdu, Pashto, are highest priorities. We will hire more people with these languages, and we will dramatically transform language training at the CIA in order to reach our goals. Every officer, ultimately in analysis and operations, should be trained in some kind of foreign language. The second workforce initiative I focused on is diversity. We're redoubling our efforts to recruit, to retain, and to develop officers from every race, religion, culture, educational background. It's important to our ability to operate throughout the world. We have to look like the face of the world that we're dealing with. At the CIA, diversity of the workforce equals diversity of thought. It's fundamental to producing good intelligence. A major goal is to increase minority hiring so that the agency moves beyond the 30% minority, moves towards, rather, a 30% minority employee ratio within our department. We're at roughly about somewhere around 20%. We need to get to another 10%. About a third of our new hires already are from minority communities, and I think that's going to rise. A big part of this will be the expansion of national origin hiring, first and second generation Americans from ethnic communities, such as Arab Americans, Chinese Americans, Hispanic Americans, and so on. The end state should be a CIA, as I said, that looks like the nation we serve and the world we engage in. It's the right thing to do, and it's essential to our mission. I can assure you that the men and women of the CIA are focused on the missions that I talked about and on making the agency more effective for the future. They are smart, dedicated public servants, and frankly, many of them are quite young. Over one half of the workforce at the CIA came on after 9/11. We get about 150,000 applications a year, and every time a James Bond movie comes out, we get even more. They're putting their lives on the line without any expectation of public recognition. They are very much silent warriors, and that's what my son called them after serving in Afghanistan. I'm extremely proud of them, of their patriotism, their ability to stay focused on their jobs, and most importantly, their contribution to the nation's security. As I said, this is a challenging time in our democracy. It's a challenging time for our president. In my lifetime, I have not seen so many serious issues confronting this nation at home and abroad. I often told the students at the Panetta Institute that we govern in our democracy by leadership or by crisis. This is a time in our history when the leadership of a nation is being tested as to whether courage or crisis will drive policy. Our forefathers passed to each generation the duty to lead in order to keep the torch of freedom bright and safe. For those of us at the Central Intelligence Agency, that is not just our duty. It is our solemn pledge to a government of, by, and for all people. Thank you.
Our thanks to Leon Panetta, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, for that very thoughtful presentation. Now we have an almost overwhelming number of questions, and so let's try to fit in as many as we can. Let's start with that question of trust that you mentioned, trust being essential for the intelligence community to work and efforts to restore trust. There are a number of questions along those lines from the audience, but let me just summarize them by asking you, what steps are you taking to restore trust with Congress, with the American people, and so forth?
Well, I always found throughout my public career that the most important thing to do in public service is to be straight with the people that you deal with. And number one, that's what I'm trying to do, is to be very direct and honest with the president, with those that I have to deal with in the White House, with those I have to deal with in the Congress, and frankly, with those that I deal with at the CIA. It's important to be direct, to be honest, not to try to hedge or to try to hide what is taking place. And I've always found that that's a pretty good rule. When I represented the district that I had the honor of serving in the Central Coast, I always found that, oftentimes you're going to take a vote that will displease people. But if they think you're casting that vote because you truly believe it's the right vote, even if they don't agree with you, they will in the end respect you. And I guess that's what I'm trying to do at the CIA. They're not going to agree with all the things we do. They're not going to agree with many of the challenges that we have to face and how we're facing them. But I only ask that they respect the fact that we are approaching those challenges in an honest and forthright way, and we are doing what we believe is right for the country.
There are a couple questions just factually about how you work. How much FaceTime do you get each week with the president?
The president, particularly over the last few weeks on these reviews of Afghanistan and Pakistan strategy, are involving sessions that can sometimes stretch 3 and 3.5 hours at a time. So I've gotten plenty of FaceTime with the president of the United States as a result of that. Normally, outside of those kinds of reviews, I will meet with the president once or twice during the week, and sometimes more, depending on whether or not there's a particular crisis or concern that he has. So I feel very comfortable with the relationship with the president. I think, as importantly, it's important to work through the National Security Council, which basically serves as his tool to develop approaches for him as he confronts the various issues that he has to deal with in foreign affairs.
Admiral Dennis Blair was here recently at the Commonwealth Club, and one person would like to know, what is the relationship between the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence? How do those two entities work together?
As you know, the Director of National Intelligence was established, I guess, it was following 9/11 because of the concerns that came out of some of the intelligence failures and the failure to share information. And at the time, the Congress, as it sometimes will do, does not develop clear lanes in the road as to how the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, and the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community can operate. So for a period of 5 years, there's oftentimes been conflicts in that relationship. Having said that, both Admiral Blair and I have a good relationship. We talk with each other. We try to ensure that we communicate on the issues he's confronting. There is a responsibility here. There clearly is a responsibility for a Director of National Intelligence of coordinating the intelligence community. There are some 16 agencies that are part of our intelligence arena, NSA, FBI, some of our imagery agencies that are involved. So there are a number of those, the DIA at the Pentagon. Those agencies need to be coordinated. We need to develop intelligence priorities for the president. We need to share information. On an issue like cybersecurity, it's extremely important that the Director of National Intelligence be able to provide guidelines as we deal with that kind of issue because it has so many cross-cutting elements throughout the intelligence community. At the same time, those of us who are within the intelligence community have to have the operational authority to do our job, to operate with our station chiefs, to do the foreign liaison that's necessary, to do the covert actions that are necessary. So those lanes in the road need to be there. And at the present time, we have asked the National Security Council and the Vice President to try to define those paths so that we can operate better for the future. And I'm confident that that's going to happen.
How are you working to improve the reliability of intelligence in comparison with possibly flawed intelligence in prior years?
That, you know, people ask me, what keeps you up at night? That's one of the issues that keeps me up at night, is to make sure that the information that we are providing really does represent the most accurate intelligence that we can provide. Now, as you can understand, we will sometimes get information. I mean, we have to rely on sources that provide information. And sometimes those sources are reliable, and frankly, sometimes those sources are not reliable, in which event we have to check and double-check that information with other sources. Sometimes it's human intelligence, sometimes it's technical intelligence, in order to determine whether or not that information is reliable. Sometimes you can't check that information, in which event, when you present it to the president and to the leaders of the country, you've got to say we have low confidence that this is accurate information. And I think looking back on the weapons of mass destruction issue in Iraq, I think that while everybody had come to the conclusion that those weapons were there, that they were present, that in reality, when you looked at the sources of the information, frankly, it should have been presented on the basis of low confidence to the president. That never happened. And I think, obviously, a price was paid for that. But what we are trying to do, learning those lessons, is to make sure that every time we present information, we make very clear that we either have low confidence, we have mid-confidence, or we have high confidence in that information, so that the president and others understand the value of the information that we're presenting to them.
Technology is obviously a way to try to improve the reliability of intelligence, the development of new technologies, and so on. And there are a whole variety of questions. Several of them deal with InQtel, the venture capital firm, essentially, of the CIA, investing in the data mining software company Visible Technologies. Are CIA departments mining U.S. internet data similar to the Defense Department? current story in Wired magazine about the new software Visible to monitor internet blogs and other websites. Do you think this is necessary and why?
Well, again, there are laws here that have to be abided by, and FISA, the law that's Foreign Intelligence Security Act, I believe is what it stands for, requires that when those efforts are made, that permission has to be provided by the FISA court. Most of that, I have to say, is within the realm of NSA, not the CIA. We don't do anything within the country that involves that kind of effort. Now, abroad, we do, particularly when it comes to Al-Qaeda and others who may use laptops, who use cell phones, we are able to go after that kind of information. That's a reality. Those of you that have cell phones and laptops, be very careful because, the technology is there to be able to do that. And in Pakistan, for example, even as we speak, if somebody, is making a cell phone call and is at the same time planning to conduct a suicide attack, we have means of trying to locate that individual so that we can hopefully prevent that. So there are advanced technologies here to be able to help protect the country, but those technologies and those capabilities ought clearly to be used in accordance with our laws.
You listed the four challenges, and all of them have threats associated with them, whether it is the unexpected political developments in Latin America or cyber terrorism, or et cetera. The list of threats would have been quite different 10 years ago, and several people would like to know, for instance, what about China in terms of its competition? Is it a threat from the intelligence point of view? What about Russia? Is it a threat both vis-a-vis Europe and the path of oil, Georgia, and so on? So what about what's not on your list in terms of attention from the CIA?
Well, again, let me emphasize that fourth area that involves our global arena that we have to continue to focus on. Yes, we're focusing on counterterrorism, Al-Qaeda, and those who would threaten our country. Yes, we're focusing on counterproliferation and those who are involved in spreading weapons of mass destruction. Yes, we are focusing on cybersecurity because of the number of attacks that we're confronting here and abroad. But we also have to be aware of what else is happening in the global world that we live in. And for that reason, we cannot avoid the responsibility to continue to gather information in other areas. We continue to gather information, obviously, on Russia. Russia remains a very important country in the world, one that we continue to deal with diplomatically, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But we need to know, what are they thinking? We need to know, what are their plans? We need to know, what are their thoughts in terms of being able to develop either energy resources or relationships with countries in that part of the world. It's an extremely important target for us. Same thing is true for China. China is now a very strong economic partner in many ways. And yet at the same time, we have to be concerned about what are they working on? What are they planning? What are their leaders thinking in terms of their approaches? So we continue to have that as a target that we look at. We continue to look at other countries, as I mentioned, particularly countries like Yemen and Somalia that could be potential safe havens for Al-Qaeda. Sometimes the tendency is to ignore those countries. But I can tell you that those countries that that have serious problems are the countries that Al-Qaeda can find roots in, and we've got to deal with that. We've got to deal with a country like Venezuela and the potential threat that it represents in terms of our relationship with Latin America. We have to deal with a country. We are now in the effort of trying to develop better relations with Cuba. We need to develop better information about what's happening in Cuba, something, frankly, we have not had as effectively as we should. We need to be able to understand Mexico. Mexico is now dealing with a horrific drug problem that we're involved with. We've got to understand what's going on there, because it clearly impacts on our country and on our security. Country after country, Malaysia, Indonesia, Burma, that part of the world, African countries, Kenya, and other countries there that represent potential problems for the future. We have got to have our people there knowing what's going on so that, as I said, this country is not surprised. That's the responsibility of the CIA. And I have to tell you, one of the problems we often have is that, you know, you have priorities that everyone's focusing on. Those are the crises of the moment. What I've got to make sure is that we are also paying attention to those areas that may not be a crisis now, but could potentially be a crisis in the future.
If you can say here, where is the economic pinch felt most? Where do you most regret not being able to put more resources, if you can say?
To be frank, the intelligence budget has done pretty well since 9/11. I don't. Again, I put on my director of OMB hat, having been on that side. But I have to say that obviously, every time there is a supplemental appropriation that's going on Capitol Hill and dealing with particularly the war zones and the and those areas where we're in conflict, that the intelligence community has always been able to draw adequate resources, more than adequate resources, to deal with the issues that we're dealing with. And we continue to get strong support from the Congress. We get very strong support in all of those areas that I just described. And I am particularly happy that I'm getting strong support with regards to language training and with regards to our effort to push greater diversity within the CIA. Having said that, as I remind the people who are heads of their directorates at the CIA and headquarters individuals, that as a former chair of the Budget Committee and as director of OMB, this country cannot continue to run trillion-dollar deficits. We're now looking at in excess of $1 trillion. The likelihood is we'll go to $2 trillion deficits. We cannot do that and expect that we can remain a powerful nation. And the reason is, as you all know, when you run those size deficits, the borrowing that we have to do around the world obviously continues to increase interest pressures here at home. It makes us more dependent on those countries that are purchasing our securities, and over 50% of our debt is now owned abroad. In addition, it deprives the country of the resources we need, regardless of what your priority is, whether it's defense, whether it's intelligence, whether it's education, whether it's health care. This country will not have the resources to confront the problems that we need to confront for the future. And worst of all, it raises, I think, the most regressive tax of all, which is the tax on our children, who have to ultimately pay the interest on that debt. So I think there is going to be a point in time. I don't know when that is, because again, putting on my budget hat, I think there's always a tendency when you can borrow money, it becomes a bad habit. It's been true in California, and it's true in Washington. And yet both parties are going to have to confront this challenge. As a result of that, I think there will be a time when we will face constrictions, both in the intelligence area and the defense area. And I think we have to make clear to the American people that however we're spending money, we're spending it in a way that is responsible and that's getting the best bang for the buck. I have to justify what we're doing at the CIA, that every dollar we spend is helping to make this country safer. If I can do that, then I can go up to Capitol Hill and defend any budget. But everybody is going to have to, in a very real way, be able to make that same case to the Congress, because we cannot go on doing what we're doing now.
Thank you. You mentioned collecting intelligence related to climate change. So what data do you collect, and who do you report it to? Who's on climate change? So presumably you're collecting data on rising sea levels or whatever. Who's the recipient of that data, and then what do they do about it?
We are, we obviously have a great deal of imagery that's available to us, and the imagery tells us an awful lot about what's happening with regards to global warming. Amazing imagery, some of it has been released to the public, and we continue to provide it to people that are involved on the issue, where you can see what's happening with regards to rising sea levels, where you can see what's happening with weather systems and the kind of droughts that are impacting in various parts of the world. And what we've done is, we are looking at that imagery. We are talking to those that are involved in the climate arena. And our analysts are basically saying where the potential threats are to our national security as a result of that. And we will provide that, as we always do, to those that are our customers with regards to intelligence. We will share it with the people who receive all of our intelligence briefings, so that as part of the intelligence package we present, they'll be able to look at this potential threat to our security issues.
There are many questions about the drone issue. Why have CIA drones over Pakistan started targeting enemies of Pakistan unrelated to the war on terror? Isn't this a dangerous precedent to set in allowing the objectives of the war on terror to expand so broadly? Long-range drone technology is proliferating. It will supersede missile delivery systems. Is America prepared to reap as we sowed, and soon DC insiders will hear drones overhead? And so forth. Many, many questions about the prudence of drones and the importance of using drones.
Well, obviously, I'm not going to talk about the operations that we conduct, in Pakistan, in particular, because it is a covert operation.
I'm sorry, he's already answering the question. Thank you.
No.
Excuse
well, let me explain, because I know the article that you're referring to, and I understand. But let me make very clear that you can leave her there. That's part of a forum. The method, what we try to do, and I think I can assure you that we do this, is that when we use it, it is very precise and it limits collateral damage. We do not use it in a way that involves the numbers that you just described. Now, there are others that are operating in that part of the world. Military has drones. Others have those facilities as well. There are airplane attacks that take place that sometimes are said to be the result of drone attacks. All of that, sometimes becomes part of the attack that's made with regards to the use of this weapon. The reality is that as far as the use of that weapon, we have targeted those who are enemies of the United States, and we have deliberately made sure that only those that represent those kinds of targets are the ones that we're going to go after.
These 41 airstrikes
in Pakistan have been
outside. Only six.
That's not true.
Who were the rest of
those people? It's not true. I'm not going to get into classified information on that. All I can tell you is it's not true.
And we have to trust you.
Okay, thank you. Here's another slightly tough question. A lot of people are concerned about the Patriot Act and the FISA requirements from both perspectives. Are they too limiting for you in terms of the FISA requirements? What do you think of the current Patriot Act? Can you work within this framework? and so on.
On as I understand, right now, the Congress is considering the reauthorization on the Patriot Act, and the administration has made its position known to the Congress. And as far as we are concerned at the CIA, I think we certainly are operating within the requirements of the Patriot Act, and I've indicated my views internally to the administration with regards to the approach on the reauthorization, and I'm going to leave it there.
Unfortunately, we are at the point at which we can ask only one more question, and you may not like this question, but I have a feeling I know the answer to it. There are people who would like to know, once you finish this challenge, would you take on another challenge for the country? What might your future be? What do you see ahead?
My future is to go back to Carmel Valley. And, you know, I've enjoyed every job that I've had in public life over the 40 years, and I'm enjoying this challenge very much. But I also enjoy the ability to go back home and enjoy what I think is one of the most beautiful areas in the world, the Monterey Peninsula. So after I'm through with this job, you can bet, and my wife can assure you, that I'm going back to Carmel Valley. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Leon Panetta, Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And Director Panetta, thank you for your service. We know that it's not an easy spot. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. Please do stay seated, if you would, until Director Panetta has left the room. I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.